Good evening, everyone. Happy New Year. Let me welcome you to this, the first of our visiting speakers for 2015. I'm delighted to be able to welcome our guest this evening, Dr. Jan-Hinrich Meyer-Sahling, who is Associate Professor of European Politics at the University of Nottingham at the School of Politics and International Relations. His research concentrates on the reform of the state in Central and Eastern Europe and the Western Balkans. He currently works on problems surrounding the establishment of professional civil service systems, the contribution of the EU to civil service reform, and the consequence of a lack of professional bureaucracies for corruption. The title of his talk this evening is Bureaucracy and Corruption in Central and Eastern Europe and the Balkans, the Perspective of Public Officials. Yeah.
Good, okay. Well, thank you very much, first of all, for the very good introduction and good evening, and thank you for giving me the opportunity to present some of my research here to you. It's always very emotional to come back to the LSE because, as I said to James already earlier, this is where somewhat the adventure for me in the UK began, because I came once as a master's student to the LSE and my PhD here. And 10 years ago, I went then to Nottingham. So it's also coming back to a place where everything began for me. Now, for those who don't know me so much, let me just put this a little bit in context of what I'm actually trying to present here. My research over the last few years has been on the European Union political system to some extent. I've also worked on the Europeanization of national political systems in Western Europe, executives and parliaments. But if I look at the core of my own research, it's probably about public administration in Central and Eastern Europe, and for the last few years also in the Western Balkans. And if I talk about public administration, my focus has probably been on the civil service. Now, when looking at the establishment of professional civil services in post-communist Europe, then I've looked at it from the perspective of institutional reform. I've looked at the quality of implementation. I've spent quite a lot of time looking at politicization, patronage, those kind of questions, all kinds of pathologies of reform. And I've looked at it also from different perspectives of what actually explains often the rather disappointing reform progress in the region after the fall of communism, and we are talking now about 25 years. So I've looked at it from the perspective of political competition on parties that have an interest in patronage. I've looked at the impact of historical legacies and the impact of the European Union. But one question that came up very often when I was discussing civil service reform in one way or another was this kind of question, but so what now? Does it actually matter if you have a lot of politicization there, if you have reform delays? So does it actually matter for the quality of democracy? Does it matter for economic development? And so often I thought that, of course, it matters quite a lot, but I rarely had hard evidence. What I rather had was anecdotal evidence from the many interviews that I ran across the region from Estonia down to Albania, we could say. And so I think this is where this paper comes in, where basically I'm trying to address this kind of question that comes up again and again and again. Does actually the quality of the civil service actually matter for outcomes and for the quality of government? And here, the answer that I basically provide is that that it matters definitely for corruption. So what I'm doing in this paper is to provide some new evidence on civil service or the quality of civil service management in five countries: Latvia, Poland, Serbia, Croatia, and Montenegro. So we have new member states and countries that, at least at the time of research, were outside the EU. What we find is that the quality of recruitment, specifically merit recruitment, has an effect on corruption, that political appointments made to the ministerial bureaucracy have a negative impact on corruption. And we also find something about the adoption of laws, whether it's sufficient to just establish a law or whether the quality of implementation is important. And what we find is that just having laws in place is not enough, but at the end of the day, it's important that we can say something about the quality of their implementation. So beyond Uwe, this is the end. Hopefully it's not the end, right? There's only one at the moment.
You just need to open the other one, which is down there.
Sorry, what?
The other slideshow.
Ah, okay, where is it?
Down you click on it?
Down the bottom, that P.
That P, yeah, okay, good. Ah, yeah, I see, okay, perfect. Good.
And then, great.
And now?
Yeah, from beginning.
I see, okay, then I...
If you press F5...
Yeah, I'm going from beginning. Okay, sorry. I didn't realize that you... I thought that you had given me a new cover slide. And I was a bit concerned. I thought, oh, hopefully I remember my own title. So, but here we go. That explains it. Okay, so now you have a title here as well. And the title obviously gives away what I was just giving you as my introduction. Namely that what we are trying to see is whether the quality of civil service management and specifically the politicization of the civil service has a negative impact on corruption. And I should say something that I'm doing this research together with Kim Mikkelsen from the University of Aarhus, who was my PhD student for a while and is now finishing off in Aarhus. I'm going to show you a little bit more about what we are then doing there. So basically, what we are therefore trying to do is trying to understand the impact of the quality of civil service management, or as we call it more generically, bureaucratic institutions, on corruption in the ministerial bureaucracy. And while I was giving you at the introduction my kind of general point about clearly this matters, I mean the quality of the civil service matters for corruption, we believe that we can say a little bit more with the kind of paper that we are trying to give here. The thing is that there has been over the last few years quite a lot of research come out that looks at the relationship between bureaucracy and corruption, but most of this research does basically some form of cross-country analysis and is based on corruption perception indices that are provided, for instance, by Transparency International or by the World Bank. But this kind of research does not take into account that corruption is something that varies considerably within countries. So you have corruption that varies across sectors, across ministries. You may have those where you have privatization, for instance. This is something where you have one country point for a particular point in time, but in fact it does not take into account that it's something that varies very significantly within countries. The other thing that you have about the studies on bureaucracy and corruption is that they tend to conceptualize the linkage between corruption and bureaucracy at the individual level. However, the test is later on not done at the individual level, but you have some form of macro-level comparisons across the countries. And finally, what we are trying to do in our research is really to provide a new perspective where we are trying to give the perspective of individual public officials from the bureaucracy, and we believe that they can provide a more accurate perspective on corruption and civil service management. So basically, to come back, I lost a little bit of my plot here at the beginning because I didn't have my slides as I was expected to have them. But so what we are trying to do and where we are trying to, let's say, innovate with this kind of research is that rather than doing some form of cross-country research that is based on cross-country, on country data, we are trying to provide new evidence that is based on the perception or survey data that surveys individual civil servants in the ministries, and it tries to ask them about problems of corruption in their work sphere, in their work organization. And this is a perspective that so far we haven't really had in the literature, and we try to see whether, when we use this kind of new data, whether actually the kind of results of the cross-country studies are actually still holding or they are not. So this is basically what we are trying to get to, and what we are finding at the end is that merit recruitment and politicization are quite important for corruption, and so is the quality of the implementation of laws. Now, let me try to give you a little bit of a background. Let me talk a little bit about corruption and then about the debate between bureaucracy and corruption in general and in post-communist Europe more specifically. And then I'm going to introduce the data on those kind of five countries where we ran a survey within the ministries. And then I will obviously show you the results. Now, without going too much into the details of the debate on corruption, at least I need to give you my assumptions on that. So we are taking a fairly standard definition of corruption as the abuse of public office for private gain. And we also, in a way, accept the kind of research that the consequences of corruption tend to be negative and they tend to be harmful for the economy, for society, etc. Now, when it comes to the causes of corruption, there tends to be more debate in terms of what really causes it and what not. But I think it's probably fair to say that one of the determinants of corruption on which there is agreement is that bureaucracy is important for whether you have corruption in a country or not. And so the question when it comes to the relationship relationship between bureaucracy and corruption is much more a question of what type of bureaucracy matters. Is it a Weberian bureaucracy or is it a new public management type bureaucracy? And which component of the bureaucracy matter? Is it about the salary system or is it about the recruitment system? Is it maybe about promotions or about the integrity management system? All of which are part of the, especially personnel management of administrative staff of the bureaucracy. So this is where basically the research comes in. It doesn't quite question the importance of the bureaucracy, but it questions what's actually important there. If you look at the kind of research that you have on bureaucracy and corruption globally, not just in Central and Eastern Europe, then the core of the debate has been over the last, now I think it's fair to say 2 years really, on the impact or the positive impact of Weberian-type bureaucracy, so more classic, hierarchically organized bureaucracy. This research goes back to Peter Evans and James Rauch already actually in the 1990s and has been picked up since then by the Quality of Government Institute in Gothenburg, who have run new surveys also at the cross-country level, and they have just well over 100 countries in their own surveys. Now, what this kind of research found is that most of the time merit recruitment is the kind of key component of a bureaucracy when it comes to explaining corruption. Evans and Rauch look at newly industrializing countries. They basically develop a mechanism where they say that merit recruitment implies that competent and honest civil servants are recruited into the bureaucracy and they are then socialized into a kind of behavior that will make them less corrupt. So you develop a kind of an ethos, an esprit de corps that makes the civil servants or the bureaucrats in the apparatus, in the organization, honest, and competent, and as a result of that, less corrupt. By comparison, the argument that is made by Dahlström and Lapuente and Torell by the Quality of Government Institute in Gothenburg is not so much about the recruitment of competence and honesty, but they are more focusing on a mechanism where you have a separation of interest between politicians and bureaucrats as a result of merit recruitment. So the idea is that as you have merit recruitment, you will change the accountability relations in the executive, basically, where the bureaucrats who are recruited via meritocratic means or meritocratic channels tend to rather be accountable to each other than to the politicians. As a result of that, you wouldn't quite have collusion between politicians and bureaucrats, but you rather have a kind of a separation of interests and you have a mutual checking on each other. So the meritocratically selected civil servants or bureaucrats would essentially check on potentially corrupt politicians. That's a little bit the mechanism with which they work. The important point here is that both mechanisms, Evans and Rauch, and the work by Dahlström and colleagues, is based on an individual mechanism, an individual level micro-mechanism. However, their research at the end of the day is based on cross-country research, which we, of course, should always applaud, but it doesn't quite take into account what's going on within the countries. Now, what they find then is merit recruitment is important. They also look at some of the other components of bureaucracies, such as tenure, wage levels, and the establishment of civil service laws, but for that, you'd never rarely find actually consistent effects. You also have more recent research that tries to go a little bit beyond this and tries to look at the impact of new public management reforms for Korea. That's where the research from Kwon has been conducted. And they find, for instance, that performance-related pay is associated with less corruption. Now, with this background, it is interesting to see that when you look at Central and Eastern Europe and the Western Balkans, that actually the impact of Weberian bureaucracies on corruption has not quite been studied. And the reason for that is probably that the debate on public administration reform has taken a different pathway in Central and Eastern Europe and the Western Balkans. And that to some extent is related to, obviously, the legacy of the past. So on the one hand, we have a fairly common assumption or common finding in the literature that corruption is a major problem in the region. So this probably is not much in dispute. And that civil service reform is the key component when it comes to administrative transformation in post-communist countries, mainly to overcome the legacy of an over-politicized administration of the communist period. Now, this kind of, let's say, focus on the establishment of a professional and depoliticized civil service was reinforced by the Europeanization debate, which meant made civil service reform a condition for accession. So in that context, you basically have two factors. First of all, this kind of generally transformation-related reforms, and secondly, the accession-related reforms that really concentrated on the adoption of civil service laws and the attempt to depoliticize the administration. Now, and this has an impact on the kind of research that has been done on, let's say, public administration and corruption in Central and Eastern Europe and the Western Balkans. It is interesting that you don't have any explicit research on the impact of merit recruitment on corruption in the region. But what you have is a focus on the adoption of civil service laws, and this is especially Neškova and Kostadinova, who have researched this, and who basically show that in an overtime analysis that shortly after the adoption of civil service laws, corruption declines in the countries that have passed those reforms. The argument, again, is one where they're developing their argument at the individual level. That means civil service law, they argue, basically provides conditions for the emergence of better trained and better paid civil servants. So while they are, let's say, fairly general in the way they're developing their mechanism, the understanding is, again, that once you have a civil service law in place, you tend to select civil servants with particular attributes, potentially better trained, and then the institutions that are established as a result of civil service reform set incentives and potentially sanctions for civil servants to behave in a way that they are not becoming corrupt or engage in corrupt activities. Their argument focuses really on whether or not a law has been adopted. So this is an act of parliament, and they don't really, focus much on the implementation or the quality of implementation, what happens once the law is actually on the books. And this is where probably the Europeanization debate has something specific to add, because in the Europeanization debate you have this argument about the risk of shallow Europeanization, whereby former rules have remained empty shells and they have often just been adopted in the shadow of conditionality or as a result of conditionality in response to conditionality, but they have rarely been or often not been properly applied. So in this respect, what we should say if we leverage this body of literature is that civil service laws as such are probably not sufficient to have an impact on corruption, but what we would rather need is that laws that are also properly applied in practice. The third factor that we find quite often when we look at public administration developments in the region is the impact or the problem of politicization, hence political appointments in the ministerial bureaucracy and agencies and also in the wider public sector, and the impact that this might have on corruption. I've done some work with my colleague Paul Haywood on the problem of patronage and or political appointments and corruption risks in Poland. And what we try to argue there is basically that when you have political appointments, what you tend to have is potentially personal dependencies between the master, the minister, and the appointee, because it's some form of personal dependence that emerges in this case. You obviously have much less screening because you don't screen on the basis of examinations, but the screening is more on the basis of personal loyalty. And you have potentially much shorter time horizons for political appointees because their own career often tends to be kind of linked to that of their political master. And when they are voted out of office, they have to look for a new job. Now, this creates a problem for the political appointees in the sense that they need to look actually at what kind of job they take after their party or minister is losing office. And this makes them, in a way, more vulnerable to outside pressures. Now, with this in mind, we can basically say that we have, three or altogether four hypotheses that we are trying to work with in our research. So the first one is that we are we essentially leverage the literature that we have, that however has only been assessed at the country level, and we basically hypothesize that we have public officials and when they would experience less corruption at their own workplace, which is their department potentially, if personnel management is regulated by civil service law, in other words, which law needs to exist in one way or another, if the law is fully implemented and hence properly applied, if recruitment is based on merit, that draws on the literature on Weberianness, and finally, we would have public officials experience more corruption if we have more political appointments at their workplace in their organization. Now, the question, obviously, is still whether some of these variables are actually related to each other or whether we can look at them separately. The literature so far has looked at them rather separately or independently. But we believe that, obviously, if you have a civil service law in place, it's a first condition for implementation to have have any impact. And it's also the starting point for merit recruitment procedure to be institutionalized. In other words, what we believe is that there might be a causal chain at work, and not just it might not just make sense to look at those kind of hypotheses independently. And we are going to look at this later on in our analysis. Now, let me then introduce you to the data that I collected in the context of an OECD Sigma project that I ran in 2010, 11, and 12. And the project at that time was about civil service professionalization in the Western Balkans. What I tried to do is I had done one research project on civil service reform after accession in the new member states in 2008 and 2009, and was then asked to do another project of a similar type on the Western Balkans. And that gave me an opportunity to not just run the surveys in the countries of the Western Balkans, but to also basically go back to some of my former contacts from the new member states and to ask whether we can actually run the same kind of survey there. As a result of that, there are the survey data that we were able to collect is basically survey data from most Western Balkan states. And here we have included those where we have a significantly, well, a relatively large number of respondents. And for comparison, we also have Poland and Latvia from among the new member states. Now, this survey is in a way fairly unique because usually it's quite difficult to get access to ministries to run surveys there. And most of it is really about, you know, how the civil service works in practice and what kind of attitudes civil servants have towards principles of public administration. However, what you see here is that we have altogether from the five countries almost 4,000 responses, which is quite a lot. We ran this as a web-based survey. A web-based survey has the big advantage that you can access a larger number of potential respondents, but it has the disadvantage that you can often not exactly control who gets the link and who has the opportunity really to reply to the online survey. So we also cannot exactly determine the response rate that we have, but we can say from some of the other data that we received that we are usually around 15 to 20, 25% of the civil servants that we were able to survey in the context of the survey, which is probably not a bad result. It's quite clear that there are inevitably some biases involved. There is nothing you can really do about it. So we try to get a little bit of data on the actual distribution of civil servants across male, female, or the age distribution. And what we see is that, by and large, the representativeness is not bad. So we have, for instance, for Poland, a few more men than women in the population. And generally, we tend to have slightly more young respondents than we would have in the actual population of the civil service, which makes sense because it is an online survey. So you would expect them also to be more readily available for this kind of survey. However, we can control for this by basically controlling for gender, age, the experience and number of years civil servants have worked in the administration, etc., whether they are managers or not. So this means that at least we have relatively good data in some countries, Poland and Croatia. We have 1,000 responses. However, I should also say that there's inevitably a huge problem with missingness, because especially when you run an online survey, sometimes you have people just hitting the survey, but they're not completing it at all, or they complete only parts of it. And this reduces the number of responses that we are working with at the end. However, we have tried to address those issues. Let me say something about the country cases themselves. So we have tried not just to do one country, which would have been sometimes easier to sell as a story, but to include basically countries that differ with regard to the problem of corruption and also with regard to the way the civil service is managed. So if you look at the region itself, you see that Estonia is in the TI ranking somewhere 28 for 2011. When the survey was run, and Kosovo is at 112. So in the region, you have quite a lot of variation. We don't capture the whole variation, but at least some of it. And I think what it means for us is that if our results hold in fairly different settings, then we increase the generalizability of our results. this is at least what we are trying to do with this. But it's also important that we have variation with regard to our civil service reforms, and I'm going to show you this in a table. If you look at the region and you look just at civil service reform, you can see, I mean, one thing that is quite interesting is that all the countries that are in the EU and those that are knocking on the EU's door in one way or another, they in fact have all engaged in some form of civil service reform. The only country in the whole region that has not implemented a civil service law is the Czech Republic. Yeah, and even there is now a new attempt to pass it. There was once a law passed in 2004, but it was never implemented. So the Czech Republic is a real outlier. Otherwise, Kosovo was the last one to basically join the civil service reform bandwagon, we could say, when in 2010 the civil service law replaced the former UN MIC regulation that existed since 2001. So from that point of view, you have actually quite some convergence across the region. However, if you unpack a little bit the civil service laws, you see quite some interesting variation. You see interesting variation in terms of trajectories. Those countries that moved fairly early, like Estonia and Latvia and Hungary. Others that moved in the late 1990s in the context of accession conditionality. And then you have the ones that moved as a kind of like the last wave, Serbia and Montenegro, after the second transition in the mid-2000s, 2005 and 2004. Since then, Montenegro, for instance, has replaced the law again. If you look at the contents with regard to merit procedures, just to give you an idea there, you see that, for instance, open competition in terms of advertisements, open announcement of vacancies. This is done basically everywhere. You have personal interviews, which is also done everywhere. But when it comes to written examinations, you have quite a lot of variation across the region, which is in itself an interesting puzzle to explain at some point. So you see that countries like Latvia have actually no written examinations, but occasionally they are done. You have other countries like Poland, where it's done only for a small group of civil servants, in Croatia, where it's compulsory, but it's decentralized into the ministries, the actual implementation. In Serbia, it's optional. And in Montenegro, it's centralized, but actually the kind of threshold you have to pass in order to pass an exam is not particularly high. Now, what this means is that there is a lot of scope for variation in the way civil service management procedures are implemented within countries. And this is the key point here, because if you look at the research, usually you have a dummy variable for a particular country. Civil service law has been adopted, yes or no. And I think the point that we want to make here is that you have potentially quite a significant variation within countries when it comes to corruption and when it comes to the management of the civil service. You may have some ministries with a lot of political appointments and others with very few. You may have some ministries where you have written examinations that are continuously applied and others where this is not the case. And in order to deal with this, to take advantage of this kind of variation, we are basically really asking now our civil servants how they experience the management of personnel in their own work organization. Now, let's look a little bit at the operationalization of our survey questions. This obviously is also always an issue of discussion or kind of a critical discussion. When it comes to corruption, this is a complex concept, no question about it. We have one question in the survey that asks whether in the last 12 months there have been rumors that firms pay kickbacks to officials in my ministry. Now, it means, first of all, if you have kickbacks, that this is a specific type of corruption. It's not all kinds of corruption. It's also clear that we are not looking at bribes paid to police officers, but we look at corrupt activities at the level of the ministerial bureaucracy, where you might have procurement contracts or so, and some kind of kickbacks that are paid in that kind of respect. We also don't ask whether the actual civil servant has actually received a kickback, because probably we wouldn't receive lots of answers, but we ask for rumors in the work organization in order to get some responses. This clearly means that we still don't have a perfect measurement. I mean, there are clearly limits to it, but at the same time, we are trying to get as far as possible and at least to try to get to the individual perception, the individual experience with corruption of this particular type. So we would still hope that we can make a larger contribution. The regulation of a civil service law, the question there is like whether personnel management is regulated by a civil service law. Here again, it's very important that while we would say a civil service law exists, yes or no, There is a lot of scope for variation in the way civil servants experience this in their own administration, because you have public service laws in place, you have temporary appointments that are made in the administration. So you have potentially a lot of scope for different forms of experience. If you look at Serbia and Montenegro, especially Serbia, you have a lot of temporary appointments to the public, to the ministerial bureaucracy, and this has an impact on how the civil service law actually regulates personnel there. Then with regard to implementation, we'll ask whether civil service law is applied in the daily practice of personnel management. With regard to merit recruitment, we ask whether officials are recruited on the basis of qualifications and skills. With regard to party patronage, we'll ask quite specifically whether parties place their supporters in the ministerial structure. And finally, we have a number of controls, as I mentioned already earlier. Now, let me show you a few mean responses, and then I'll show you a little bit about what I find within the countries, and then I'll show you the results for our hypotheses. Now, if you look, first of all, at the mean responses, there are quite a few numbers that you find here. So obviously, it's very easy to get lost among them, but I thought at least I'd show you some raw numbers here. Now, the kickback measure shows there on the left. I mean, first of all, you see something about the number of responses that we include, and because we exclude our don't knows and our missing values, the number shrinks. When it comes to the kickbacks, you see that Croatia has the highest corruption score, and that Latvia is the one with the lowest. You also see that Serbia and Croatia are higher than Latvia and Poland, in fact Montenegro as well. So there seems to be at least a kind of regional difference there. And if you try to compare this to TI scores, I mean, the correlation is relatively high. So it's at least shows us something there. If you look at the mean responses here for the independent variables, you see, first of all, that if the scale is from 1 to 5, 1 is lowest and 5 is highest, so these are all Likert scale questions that we use, you see that the highest scores are generally for the question on civil service laws, which reflects that there are laws in place. So civil servants, if they say, I mean, if the mean score is 4, I mean, they agree with the fact that a civil service law is important for what's happening at their workplace. And you also see that the scores for the civil service law are always higher than the one for the implementation of the civil service law, which recognizes that in almost probably all countries there are potentially implementation gaps, or that the implementation is not always perfect in the way civil servants perceive their own workplace. If you look at merit recruitment and party patronage, again, it's quite interesting to see for merit recruitment that for Latvia it's the highest. Montenegro is remarkably high here, but then Croatia and Serbia again come out on the bottom. And if you look for party patronage, that Croatia has the highest at that time. These are the final days of the conservative government, the Kosovo government at that time. And you have Poland relatively high too, and Serbia, while Montenegro and Latvia have lower scores. What's interesting to see is also that merit recruitment and patronage can sometimes go together. So you have Poland with a fairly high patronage score and a fairly high merit recruitment score. So they do not inversely relate to each other, not always. But generally, I mean, you can already get a sense that in Croatia you have more patronage, less merit recruitment, and more corruption. And Serbia is coming close to that, while Latvia is, in a way, the good story here. Let's look a little bit more at the variation within the countries now, where we basically now come to the point that if you have one World Bank score or one Transparency International point per country per year, you might not capture everything. What's interesting, if you just look at the kickback measure, so this is just the corruption measure, and we'll ask about the kind of responses for individual countries, you see that the modal response is usually disagree. Disagree means we disagree with rumors of kickbacks. So probably in the ministries, I mean, there are not that many rumors of kickbacks. The exception is Croatia here, which is quite interesting, actually, that they are coming out so, badly in a way. But otherwise, you see only it depends on, to what extent they really disagree with that. And I guess this sometimes conflicts a little bit with the external observer perception, which is often driven by big scandals or so. But let's look at the ministries. So I don't expect you to read all of this here. Yeah, this is not the idea. But the point is that there's something about variation within countries that we are trying to capture here. So while I showed you five mean scores earlier, what we can see here is that we have some ministries now with very high mean scores for kickbacks and some that have a very low score. And this tells us really that the kind of variation in terms of corruption that we have within a country is potentially very, very high. And this means that aggregating this into a single country measure may be sometimes quite misleading. You also see that there are kind of common, or kind of almost as you would expect, certain suspects here. Finance, transport, health, culture, yeah, economy. And at the other end, you have ministries such as public administration, prime minister's office. In Poland, the regional development office, which makes a lot of sense because this is largely a ministry that deals with EU policies. Defense in some countries like Montenegro, which may be surprising if you read the corruption literature, but for the Western Balkans, it makes sense because of NATO. So Montenegro, the Ministry of Defense, is one of the cleanest ministries. I think for Bosnia, probably those of you who work on Bosnia would agree that this might even be the case there. So they are often the good stories when it comes to civil service reform. But so you see a certain kind of clustering of ministries rather than countries. But however, it's not that for all countries that's the same, that public administration and justice ministries are always on the low side. So you also have sometimes surprises there. Let me try to give you this in a different way. I mean, just to show it to you in a different way. So if you have the variation across the ministries with regard to our kickback measure, you see that the usual suspects are here the ones with a high measure: education, finance, health. Yeah, I don't think that it's too surprising, but the differences are sometimes quite big. Maybe not for Latvia, but if you have for Croatia here, I mean, these are huge differences, significant differences. Yeah, if you examine that, and you have the usual suspects, you might say for those with few kickbacks and few opportunities for kickbacks, such as foreign affairs, prime minister's office, public administration, and the government secretariat. I show you this for patronage as well, which is maybe a little bit less. I mean, we might not say, oh, these are kind of ministries where we would expect a lot of political appointments. But we can already see quite quickly that there are certain ministries that tend to be slightly more politicized. And this also reflects some other research that I've done on patronage across ministries and policy sectors in the Western Balkans and in Hungary. And so you see like education, agriculture, economy, health, information technology. I was a bit surprised it's a small ministry actually, with fairly high numbers of political appointments. Education might be a bit surprising here because this is often one with actually fewer political appointments. Yeah. Again, you see Poland also with low for defense there, labor, interior, public administration. But so I think what it really shows us that, I mean, there is quite a lot of variation within the countries. Now, let me show you now something about our analysis. So what we are trying to do is to basically run a regression analysis on our survey data. And this shows you now three different models. And the first one that we do is one where we only look at the impact of civil service laws and the controls and nothing else. Then we have a second model where we also look at the implementation. And the third one, which is the one with the triangles, is the one where we look at everything. Yeah, where we basically include all our hypotheses, all our variables. Now, if you only look at the impact of a civil service law, then this is the result here. Here we have our diamond. And it means that if you only look at the impact of whether or not a civil service law exists on corruption, then you find a significant effect. If it regulates it, or if it's perceived to be regulating, then we have fewer rumors of corruption or kickbacks in that particular work organization. However, this kind of effect disappears once we control for the quality of implementation. So this is the one with our squares. So in the moment in which we include the squares, then here, as you can see, the civil service law variable becomes insignificant. And here is basically the second variable on the quality of implementation, which is highly significant. And finally, if we include the full model, then we still have a situation where our civil service law variable is not significant, and the size of the coefficient of the implementation variable declines but remains significant. And we see here merit recruitment and politicization, or patronage, both of which are highly significant variables. In other words, confirming our hypotheses. And what it essentially means is that if we look at our four hypotheses, we find support now for the one on merit recruitment, on politicization, and on implementation, while the one on the law itself is not properly confirmed. I have the regression results here. If you care later on, you can see this was the first model that I showed you, the second and the third. Here we have just looking at the different controls. So we control for countries basically using the fixed effects models, and we try to look at, you know, whether the controls have an impact or not. So if you are, of course, interested in that, we can go back to that later on. Let me now try to show you something about the relationship between the variables as a path model. And so what we have tried to do there is basically to look whether how the civil service law affects the quality of implementation, affects merit recruitment and party patronage, which then affects kickbacks. And that what we see in that case is that actually the impact of the law becomes important. But what we can therefore conclude, here you see the direct effect, which is obviously nothing. Yeah. But once you actually do the path, it becomes a significant effect. So what we can basically conclude for that is that three of our hypotheses are essentially confirmed, and the fourth one about the importance of the civil service law, it's not that it doesn't matter, but what we can say is that it has only an indirect effect when we basically see how it works through the other variables, how it affects the other variables, and then has an effect on our final outcome. Now, let me conclude then. So basically what we can say here is something about the quality of bureaucracy and corruption in the new member states and some potential candidate states. What we have tried to do here is essentially to use new evidence from a survey of civil servants rather than to use country data. And what we find there is obviously that, yes, merit recruitment and political appointments are important. Civil service laws with an indirect effect and implementation is relevant too. The next question for that is obviously one about looking at different types of personnel management functions. So the survey allows us to say something about salaries, it allows us to say something about integrity management and so on. So we are trying to now disentangle that further and try to see what's the impact of having asset declaration systems, what's the impact of having disciplinary codes, what's the impact of having codes of conduct, codes of ethics applied in your institution in order to get a sense of whether this works as well. And of course, an interesting question is whether there are other parts of bureaucracy about delegation or the structure of the bureaucracy or, you know, audit, etc., how they really matter. So the field is probably open. Yes, so thank you very much for your attention. I hope I got my message actually across, because I lost a bit of plot at the very beginning with my different starting point there.
Thank you very much indeed. No, very, very interesting. Floor's now open for questions. We have about half an hour. Is that Bernard I see, or Kevin?
Adam first. You were first.
Hi, Kevin. Didn't even see you.
I think I heard an earlier variation of this presentation at a conference. Thank you. It's an excellent presentation. I was very interested with your results. I wonder if we could go back to one of the early points that you mentioned. You started off by giving us a picture of types of bureaucracy, but you mentioned in a kind of undifferentiated fashion Weberian bureaucracy, and you contrasted that conceptually with new public management. Across the various cases that you've mentioned, you highlighted in your tables, do you seek to differentiate types of bureaucracy between those countries, or can they usefully be regarded as ultimately part of a similar state tradition?
Mm-hmm. Should I come straight back to that?
Yes.
Okay. This is actually a difficult question, so which is good. Now, I think the presentation that you heard was one where I tried to map the different types of bureaucracy as they had emerged across the region. So I think what became evident there is that some of the countries were clearly trying to institutionalize Weberian features, but often they did not quite manage to realize them because, for instance, what you have for the Western Balkans is that many of those countries are actually have been very proactive with regard to institutional reform, but when it comes to the implementation, they're actually rather poor. Yeah. And I think, you know, I've not addressed this too explicitly, but I think when you go back to the kind of table that I had about merit procedures, and then subsequently the table about the means when it came to the actual practice of personnel management, you could see that the countries like Croatia, Montenegro, and Serbia in this sample there were actually the ones that had most merit procedures in place, more than Latvia and Poland. But at the same time, they were also the ones where actually the perception of merit recruitment is lower and the perception of patronage and politicization is higher. In other words, I mean, the kind of implementation gap is particularly high in those kind of countries. Yeah? So you have, we could say that, thought Weberian bureaucracies that are yet fairly politicized, or you know, I guess Weber would have maybe called them still patrimonial in one way or another. So I think this is this point about, you know, how Weberian or not Weberian are they. So you have actually, I think you have hardly any country in the region that really can claim to have institutionalized Weberian features. The one exception may be Lithuania, where you have the institutionalization of Weberian features with regard especially to recruitment and promotion, dismissals as well, salary system. And you also have a fairly high degree of depoliticization. Yeah.
I don't see, though, why that kind of merit recruitment pattern, that kind of management of integrity, whatever your phrase you use, would necessarily belong with concept A rather concept B. Why is it necessarily Weberian as opposed to other types of bureaucratic system?
Yeah, so you basically, I mean, I guess it's fair to say that the issue about integrity management is, you know, let's say less, I mean, it's something that works as well in new public management as well as it does with the Weberian bureaucracy.
Anglo-Saxons are pretty keen on it as well.
Absolutely, yeah. So I think what we are, basically what we try to do in this one is to step back and not to look at the impact of, so to come back to your original question, right? So to step back and not to exactly ask whether it's the impact of a particular type of bureaucracy, but we simply look only at a particular component. In this case, you know, clearly you would expect for a Weberian bureaucracy not just the institutional, the formal institutionalization of merit recruitment, but also, you know, meritocratic practices in place. Yeah, this would be a proper institutionalized Weberian bureaucracy. But we are trying to, in a way, we are use this, but we are trying not to say we are looking at the impact of the new public management versus the Weberian type bureaucracy, but we only zoom in on, you know, recruitment and appointment. As basically one aspect, one particular domain of civil service management, rather than actually making really a distinction of looking at the impact of this or is the new public management maybe a better one, but nonetheless, this issue about the informal institutionalization of Weberian features in the Western Balkans, which is actually in many respects, if you look at the formal institutional reform trajectories there, they look much better than many of the new member states. But if you look actually at the practices, they tend to look worse than some of the new member states. And this remains an empirical puzzle, maybe less so. I mean, there is at least some evidence, but theoretically it remains quite a puzzle. Yeah, so I mean, I'm trying to work on that, but I mean, it's difficult to actually find the best answer for that. Yeah, that's an issue, hopefully.
Okay. I'm going to ask a couple of relatively practical questions. Yes. One of which is, how did you manage to do it? Because you had to find these people, identify these people, and recruit these people to participate. Given that you were touching on a potentially rather sensitive subject, I mean, I note that at some stage you actually said, well, I'm not quite sure whether you did that, but whether you said, what I was really sort of saying I was doing was examining people's experiences of the management of personnel, or not, I was examining corruption, which might or might not facilitate access and participation, but you must have quite a lot of sort of senior management approval of this in order to be able to do it. So my practical question is a question which I was talking about with a colleague here over the last few days, which is how do you actually discuss with people sensitive subjects which either they might have a particular perception of or prefer to have a particular perception of and need to justify themselves, or certainly if you happen to access them via their management structures, highly sensitive. So that's one question. If I'm allowed to ask a slightly different question as well, I also would like you to go back to a couple of your slides, one of which was, I think, your first slide with any number, well, with numbers on, yeah, that one.
This one, no, that's the means
one. And the other one was the one which came a little bit later where you had a, that one, yeah, both of those. Now, I have to admit here that I'm an applied statistician and I've got nothing better to do. And if you go to the first one of those, I mean, given that your ends dropped down quite dramatically, I wonder whether we have actually significant differences coming up there or not. And if we go to the picture with the blue slot, with the blue bars on them. I mean, where we've now split this down, I mean, how many people were there in the Croatian Ministry of Finance, which actually allows you to say that this is 3.5, as opposed to how many people were in Serbian Public Administration, which says that it's only about, I don't know, 0.5 or something like that.
Good point, yeah.
I mean, I can't, you know, that's what it makes it difficult to actually understand quite what is coming out. And I think that here, for practical reasons, you've got to be very much more careful, and I would sort of then follow that all the way through the outcomes that come out of this and the measured outcomes. I mean, I'm highly suspicious of some of this. I'm presuming that actually just the last one, where you had the four different models or something with Roman, I mean, I'm presuming that the ends at the bottom of this are some number of people. These are all the people who are in the sample or something like that. Yeah, so those are people. Okay,
They are.
But I mean,
so you still have like 1,500.
You might have 1,500 there, yes. Okay, but I mean, this might actually be all the problems associated with multi-level modelling as well. I will give you a paper by somebody called Simon Jenkins to read afterwards, which tells you how to be terribly careful about doing things like this. Yeah. Because in fact, you might be reducing your ends right down to your smallest numbers, and you haven't really got 1,500 there at all.
Yeah. Okay. Good. So just come back straight to that.
Yeah.
I mean, okay. First of all, on the issue about how to actually practically do it. I mean, I did this in the context of a project that I coordinated on behalf of Sigma OECD. Okay, but so you know them extremely well. The first time I did this kind of survey on the new member states, and this was actually very difficult to do. I mean, I personally thought it's probably almost impossible to run this kind of survey in the bureaucracy because some colleagues from the LSE said, like, oh, no, it's not going to work at that time. And then the commission said, but we want to do something like this. So we thought, okay, well, at least we give it a try. Maybe we get at least responses for a few countries. And then when I did my missions to the countries at that time, I basically spoke to the heads of civil service agencies or sometimes ministers of public administration or state secretaries in charge of the government secretariat, and asked them, basically introduced the project to them and the kind of survey I wanted to do. This usually was kind of a way of, let's say, introducing, explaining how to do it, and to get the basically approval from the top. Then we try to basically make sure that it's distributed in the same way across the ministries. that it would get an explanatory note, and then, you know, we took it from there. So it's quite clear that it did not always work in the same way across the countries. That's what I tried to explain at the beginning about the difficulties of managing an online survey then. So in the Czech Republic, for instance, we didn't get survey data. One reason was that we just didn't have the leadership of the Ministry of Interior buying into that kind of survey project. So there was nothing we could really do. In some of the other countries, it was actually really difficult to get it off the ground. And some, you know, we got lots of responses. So for the Western Balkan project, which was then the second one, I mean, there was then the experience of the first one. So I basically could go in and do it. So we had the formal support of the OECD, then SIGMA, then DG Enlargement, and I spoke always to the people in the relevant agencies to get it going. And this, at the end of the day, I mean, got really good responses. When it comes to the qualitative, I mean, what I should maybe still say about the actual content of the survey, the largest part of the survey asks about the experience with civil service management, personnel management, really. And then there is one block at the end of questions where we ask things about, for instance, kickbacks. So it's one question out of, you know, 70 or 80 almost. You know? When it comes to qualitative interviewing, I've done obviously a lot of research on political appointments. While it seems often difficult to get people to speak, I mean, I guess once you are in an interview, yeah, I mean, at least I usually don't have that problem. I mean, people at some point like to talk about their experience. What is more difficult is to get them to talk about corruption. So I've tried this with a colleague of mine in Poland, and to have officials talking about it, you know, takes a while to warm them up in an interview, but you get information about risks that are emerging and so on. But I find it almost more difficult to do it in a qualitative way than in a quantitative way, which is not something that I expected initially. Coming to your numbers, I should say a few things. So, I mean, of course, your points are absolutely clear there. I mean, they're, like with all these kind of surveys, there are quite a few issues. And if you have this here, you see, first of all, that we had, you know, 3,900 hits on the survey, but we include only 1,500 in the actual analysis, so we are talking here about a huge degree of missingness. So what we try to work is with to work with imputations there in order to come around this, and we analyze the missing values. I mean, who are those kind of people? And what we could see there is like that most of the time, I mean, you know, it didn't really make any difference for what we had there. We could see that those who were not responding to the civil service law question tended to also respond less to the question on corruption, which is maybe plausible because they are the ones who feel that they are not sufficiently protected and therefore they have a reason not to answer the corruption question. But we didn't find any of these relationships for the others. So we were trying to obviously work with all those kind of tools that we had available in order to, you know, still get reasonable results out of it. So basically, in terms of multi-level, we have only 5 countries, so that's not exactly what we can do there. Yeah, it's too few.
Precisely, that's what you can do. Yeah. But I mean,
What I should say on this one here. I actually, as I said at the beginning, I don't expect you to read all of this here. This was really for illustration purposes, to give you a sense of, you know, very different variations. So, for instance, in this one here, this is really just only used for to give an overview. I've only those where I have at least 10 responses or 11 responses in the ministry, at least to have something there. So this does not include all the data, but it gives you, I think, a relatively sense of there's something, some variation.
Once your N is getting smaller than, you know, kind of, I mean, these things are terribly sensitive to the size of the N, and it's not a question of N, it's that 66, even that is, you know, sort of, which was on the previous one, which is a source of concern. I mean, your output will just print out for you.
You want it here?
The very first one.
This one. That one. Okay. Yeah.
Your output will print out for you a confidence interval around any one of those, just like that. And you actually find that those are. I mean, if I look at those numbers, I cannot, you know, sort of. I find it very difficult to actually sort of. I suspect that on the basis of those sort of lines which are crossing things, most of these things will be overlapping.
This is basically this one here, right? So this is basically the illustration of
that. You'd actually find ultimately an awful lot of them would be like those ones in the middle, which were sort of sitting over.
But you see, we tried it with controls, without controls, with fixed effects, without fixed effects, and you know, at the end of the day, I mean, these kind of results come out as fairly, you know, robust if you try it out. I mean, we still have 1,500 left in the analysis. It's not a small number.
Well, maybe that one, but I'm talking about the other one. This one. Yeah. I'm not disputing that. I'm talking about some of those attempts to break it.
This one's here.
Yes, those ones. I mean, this. Yeah, that one. Okay. Almost the next one. Yeah. The next one. The next one.
I mean, clearly, I've not presented any, you know, standard deviations. Nothing there. But I mean, at least it gives you a sense, roughly, where the countries stand there. I think the aggregate something which, in fact, you know,
just coming up very quickly. One of the things which I learned as a social surveyor a long time ago is the best way to get people to talk about something is when you're talking about something else. So you don't even ask the question on corruption. You actually ask them about something where there is some possible proxy which you then impute into it.
This is how we did it in the qualitative interviews. We basically asked them around how they manage their departments and how they interact with you know, business and NGOs and interest groups and so on, and that usually was a way for us to you know, somewhat get an understanding of where the risks actually are. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm interested to know whether centralised countries are highly centralised countries and public administrations are more prone to corruption than decentralised countries. I know you focused particularly just on ministries there and central government, but I wondered if you looked at the difference between civil servants based in capital, for example, or in regional offices. And in addition to this particular research project, whether you've done any research comparing central and local government, whether or not local administrations are more corrupt than others. Just interested. And secondly, if I may, I'm a civil servant in the UK, and this particular government at the moment is very keen on transparency and whistleblowing and these types of themes. And I also work on a local government project in Macedonia, and the EU is very keen on these themes, in addition to public administration, recruitment and merit-based recruitment, etc. And I just wondered if those themes were part of the questions that you looked at. And you know, freedom of information, implementation of access to public document legislation, that type of thing, and whether or not that is also having an impact on the way that civil servants go about their daily work.
No, unfortunately, we have only the central government ministries. So this means we cannot compare to regional and local offices. What I know from interviews, looking at places like Serbia, Macedonia, is often that at the regional and local level, patronage and corruption are a bigger problem. That seems to be at least, you know, the kind of evidence that you get from conversations there.
Is that central government that's telling you that?
And I mean, that's what they tell you, not just the civil servants, but also when you speak to external observers. Yeah, I mean, if you speak... The thing is that the kind of interviews that I did in the countries were usually, I mean, they were focused on the central level, on the ministries, because that was the focus of the research. But when you speak to journalists from outside, or you speak to academics, or you speak to NGOs, they would tell you, but are you also looking at local government level? There it's much worse. So that's the kind of answer that you get, kind of statement, comment that you get actually quite often. So that means actually when you look at the ministries and you look at the civil service, you look at an elite in public administration in the real sense, because the scope of civil service laws tends to be fairly small in all those countries. It's mainly those that have a university education. I mean, let's say in some countries, in Albania, it's not here, 4,000 civil servants out of 90 or 95,000 that work in public administration. So you have actually sometimes 5, 10, 15% only that are really covered only by those laws. They tend to work in the ministries themselves or some central agencies. So that also probably gives you an idea of the scale of the problem that you have in regional and especially local offices. It would be very good to look at this. I'm doing some project, another project at the moment with the Regional School of Public Administration, where again, in, you might know them in Montenegro, RESPA, exactly, and so there we again concentrate on the central level, but for some countries we try to include municipalities and regional offices. It depends, again, you know, the question that was raised earlier about actually approval, and you need to have senior officials who are interested and willing to support you to expand your research. But that will, for the first time, give me kind of a some insight into what happens actually away from the ministries. Mm-hmm. Regarding the transparency questions, no, we have not. We don't have this in this survey simply because we really focused on personnel management at that time. So the one that comes closest to it are things such as are codes of conduct applied? Do you have an asset declaration system in place? That's about as far as it goes. So I can't really say much about it. But I think a problem you have there is like in many of these areas that and the level of formal institutional reform, countries tend to do fairly well in the region. But when it comes to actually applying it, it's still that they do apply those procedures, but they don't reach the kind of results that they are intended to reach. So merit recruitment, you have the rules. Yes, exams are done, but you still don't have actually the recruitment of the best and brightest because you have informal mechanisms at work that contradict this, or the rules are not designed appropriately. And I think this is what you have in many of these transparency in a wider sense, anti-corruption type policies too, that the institutions are there. They actually, people use them in a way, but you still don't quite get the result that you're looking for. You know, I think that's the puzzle that we need to try to sort of solve.
Yeah, I'm going to go to the more the econometrics of the of the paper. I like very much the path regression, you saw at the end of the kind of causal explanation story that you proposed. But given the measure, the data that you have, I'm not quite sure you can say that. So I think each variable is kind of sorted in terms of how objective the answer is, which is then a measure of the subjectiveness of the respondent.
Mm.
So whether there's a law in the country, you can have different responses in different ministries, but it's a yes-no question. You know, at the end of the day, either there is a law or there is not a law. It doesn't matter what people believe.
Yeah.
The law is there, yeah? Mm-hmm. So what the variation you have is not whether there is a law or not, it's whether people believe there is a law or not.
Mm-hmm.
So it's more about perceptions rather than the causal effect to having a law.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? It's the causal effect to people wrongly or rightly believing there is a law, whatever that means. And then, of course, that perception, very logically, E1, affects quite strongly, 0.7, the perception, again, of people of whether the law is applied, because it's correlated both about perception of people.
Yeah.
I would argue that, again, at that level, the second level of the variable, if the law is applied, the law is applied, irrespective of in which ministry or department. It's not just about the implementation of the law. So, again, this shows less so, but still variation between ministries in terms of perception of policy effect and so on. And then you go to a third level, which is about meritocracy. Mm-hmm. Again, you know, if there is meritocracy, you can have a bit of variation in the departments, in the ministries. But again, you know, it becomes a bit more blurry up until you get to the variable of patronage, which may be much more case specific and ministry specific. So in a way, there is this ordering of the variables, which goes not in a causal effect story, but in a story of how much personal perceptions matter. And I think a way around that, a way to kind of disentangle these two possible mechanisms, would be to see how much this variable interacts with specific objective variables. And I guess the most obvious of your objective variables would be the things that you are presenting in the beginning, whether the respondent is in the Ministry of Finance, where there's big opportunities for corruption, versus the Ministry of, you know, the irrelevant ministry where there's no demand for corruption. And I wonder whether there's anything in the control variables that you had, which you mentioned in the
table,
that would allow you to say something about that. But I think you should explore that.
That's a really good point. So let me answer this, and I think there are two, three points that I need to answer to. The first one is the law question a yes-no question? And I think the point that we really try to make that this is probably the most likely case for a yes-no answer. But in reality, even when it comes to the regulation of civil service law in your institution, civil servants may the importance of a law may vary in a country and in an institution. And the simple example for that is just that you have, for instance, different scopes of civil service laws, what I mentioned earlier already. So in some cases, the top level, like the permanent secretary in the UK, is a civil servant. In other countries, it's not. Sometimes you have two or three levels that are actually not in the civil service. Poland, not during the survey, but the first survey, all the managers were political appointees. And the question is the same when you go further down the hierarchy and you say, so where do we actually draw the line now? So sometimes you may have large ministries where you have political appointments, political appointees covered by government act, others, specific political advisors, then civil servants, then you have public servants, others, police. Yeah, so you have different labor legislation for maybe auxiliary staff or administrative staff, temporary appointments, which are again covered by other legislation. So it's not so straightforward. And it depends a little bit on the ministry you are in, and it sometimes probably even depends on where you are in the ministry, how important you actually still regard as civil service law. So I think I take your point, this is clear, but I mean, I still would like to make a case for it's not just a straight yes-no, there is a little bit more to it. However, your point about the variation from how much variation do you observe for the first question, the second question, and so on, there you're of course right, and that's something we do observe, where we have a little bit more variation for the implementation question, and yet more variation within countries for merit recruitment, and then for politicization. And so the problem about causality that you mentioned is actually one that we might really have to pitch a bit further. In terms of, we have to address this also in our narrative in the paper. It's very important. With regard to the control variables that we use, so we have the individual level controls, yeah, that we use, and we use country fixed effects. What we don't use is ministry fixed effects. So I show you the graph earlier to give you a sense of variation institutionally, but we don't include the ministry fixed effects. The simple reason for that is that it reduces the number of observations further, because this was a question that in a way was optional in the survey. So what you have is just fewer responses to it, and it's just harder to work with that. So we took that out. However, I think your point is something when we discussed it or presented it elsewhere, it's similar that people ask, so what are the budgets of the ministries, their discretionary budgets, with whom do they interact in the ministries? So just including probably the ministries as a variable might be actually the right way forward to address exactly those kind of questions. And so, I mean, I'm just trying to explain to you, why we kind of tried to keep it out initially. We have used this with country and ministry fixed effects, and it does actually, despite the lower number of observations, not really affect the results. So, but at the moment, it's not even a footnote. I think what you say is we need a model for that.
Yeah. Okay, we're running out of time, and I see three questions, so I'm going to take them all as a bunch. Tenor.
So I have a question on measurements on perception specifically. So I was struck by the high indices that you mentioned for Croatia in terms of perception of corruption. And I remember reading a paper by Susan Woodward on State Capacity recently, in which she discusses this same riddle of the perceptions against what can be called as a situation on the ground, in the sense that she mentions that in many... that Croatia specifically ends up being very high on perceptions of corruption as opposed to other countries in the region, for instance Serbia, whereas in other indices on governance it's the other way around. So in that paper she concludes that there must be a problem with the perceptions of the people, and she puts a lot of hypotheses. So I just wanted to have an opinion of yours. Is here, do we have a problem with the perceptions? Or maybe do we need to take another perspective and maybe concede that there is a point in this, that even in a EU member, that even countries that in a way do better in certain governance indices have a bigger problem with corruption than we would expect it to be. Mm-hmm. So this thing. And then just very briefly, if you have measured in any way the actors involved in these episodes of corruption.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
I'll take the next two. So take it all. Yeah.
Yes, I have a pretty awkward question about it. Something struck me in the results of Poland, but...
Which was answering?
For Poland.
Okay.
If you think about corruption, the more corrupted ministries mm-hmm. were the one led by a junior coalition partner. I was wondering if there's any correlation at all between what is the level of sort of... Is it a senior coalition partner, junior coalition partner mm-hmm. who is leading the mm-hmm. ministry and the level of corruption? If you have any results of what's about that.
Mm-hmm.
Can I jump in? Very quick yeah. question. Montenegro, who was Prime Minister in 2011? Was it Djukanovic or was
no,
it Luksic?
Just
it would
change.
It would be interesting to know.
Just a change. It was just a change. It was just right afterwards. I think it was right afterwards.
So who was it?
Yeah, Luksic.
It was Luksic.
Yeah.
Probably explains a lot. Gentleman there.
Well, this is a question I barely feel I could ask in an academic place. But it's... Who actually refused to which are they ministries or things that refused to accommodate you, and can we assume that they're probably worse on the scale than the ones that you actually have been able, were able to get hold of?
Okay, that's yeah, I mean, let me start with Tennis' question about, even though they are difficult to answer. So the first one is about the perception thing and about Croatia. Let me be honest with you. There is something about Croatia. Croatia tends to be more pessimistic and negative. I spoke to some colleagues who do surveys in the region as well there, and they say, Croatia always tends to come out on the bottom. And Albania, they are always very heavy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so this is the kind of a pattern that you find quite often there.
It's the only Catholic country, isn't it?
Are they particularly skeptical?
They're very interested in sin.
Bulgaria
would
have come at the bottom. Bulgaria is usually the one that counts at the bottom. It's just not
I can't
good.
Tell you. Well, I mean...
I had the same from Croatia,
yeah,
and I would agree on that statement. So.
Yeah. You see, the thing is that... I don't know whether they are particularly skeptical or more so than the others. I mean, I can just say what I spoke to others or what I can see there from our own research on Albanians. I mean, to the extent that you get their data, they seem to be slightly more positive. Kosovo, for that matter, as well. So.
Absolutely. I mean, it comes out across in all sorts of other surveys as well.
Yeah. But I mean, what we still see is also that in a case like Croatia, I mean, it's not a general phenomenon. I mean, you see Croatian ministries that don't seem to have negative perceptions, right? So I guess because we see these kind of differences within a country, I would say that it's not a general phenomenon there. So I think that's what I can say there. And I mean, I was there when I was doing the interviews there. I mean, it was clearly... You know, when I went into the Western Balkans, and bearing in mind that I had done most of my research on the new member states before, so I came into a region, and I had not worked on it for 10 years when I started to work on public administration at that time. So for me, it was a kind of a steep learning curve. And my hypothesis, not only from the literature, but also just my personal hypothesis, was that, well, Croatia should be okay, right? When I was doing the interviews, I was just struck to see how many things are kind of lip service, and they're just not done properly, you know. And some people are actually quite honest about that, you know. So maybe that's reflected in those kind of responses. You know, so in Serbia, the same. I guess Serbia comes out in all these kind of surveys, not just... I mean, I have another survey, which is an expert survey, and it shows... similar results, and Croatia and Serbia are not doing as well as you would expect when you come from outside initially. And this kind of perception that, yeah, Serbia has got a different administrative tradition and they inherited the federal bureaucracy and so on, doesn't show up in any of the data. In terms of actors involved in corruption, we don't know, because the survey didn't capture that. So I can unfortunately not say. This is the downside of this kind of research. I mean, for Poland, we did one country and we did lots of interviews, so we got a better understanding there. But then, you know, it's actually very difficult to sell a one country case study, at least on that kind of subject at that moment. But coming to Poland, about the junior coalition partners, generally what you see is for corruption, I don't have so much the impression that it depends on the party that is in power. To some extent, because where you see the impact of the party in power more evidently is when you look at patronage. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So and you saw it for Poland quite clearly that the time of the Kaczynski governments and Marcinkiewicz, that the League of Polish Families and Samobrona, I mean, they were just raiding the ministries, mm-hmm. And they were just using them as their own spoils, more so than law and justice, and certainly more so than what. Tusk government has ever done. So you see those kind of patterns. If you look at some of the countries, you work in Macedonia, I mean, you have the ministries run by the Albanian minority parties. They tend to be far more politicized. You know? And as we see from the research, if you have more politicization, you tend to also have often more corruption. So there's a knock-on effect of that. So it's not exactly the junior coalition party. More often it is, but it also depends a bit on, is it a small party? Is it a new party? Yeah, and what's the kind of party family we're talking about? Finally, your question about who refuses to accommodate your wishes there. As I said earlier, I mean, from the survey research, it depends more on the capacity of the central civil service agency and the coordination mechanisms that it has established with ministries. So if you have Poland at the time when I ran the second survey, it was a time when coordination was working fairly well again. So the central civil service department in the prime minister's office was writing an email and saying, here's the survey, and that's for a good cause, and we are interested in that too. And they send it to the director generals in the ministries. And the director generals in the ministries, they pass it on as required. You still have different numbers of responses per ministry, it's not all the same, but actually Poland is a wonderful example where in the 2011 survey, we essentially data from all ministries, and we also have always relatively reasonably good numbers, once this capacity of the center drops, you also get struggle to actually implement a survey. So in a way, for me, the management of the survey was a way also of an understanding of how much capacity there was often at the center. I mentioned the Czech Republic earlier, where we didn't manage to get the survey off the ground because there was no center. Yeah, and Slovakia, I mean, obviously not in this one here, the survey, the center was, the central management department was too weak, wasn't able to establish contacts, so it was managed via the government office. Yeah. So sometimes you have this. From the personal interviews that I ran in countries, and Poland I have to use as my example there, I had the impression that ministries such as the Treasury, State Treasury in Poland or so, they were harder. I mean, simply because clearly there were more opportunities for corruption. Sometimes when you have more political appointments, you have a different crowd in the ministries, and it's harder to get a foot in the door there for the first few conversations. Once you're in, it's okay. But you need to make this first move. If you have professionals in the ministry, it's always easier to contact them. Of course it is. Mm. But they will talk. You will learn.
Thank you.
So, I don't know. Just my question.
Well, Jan, thank you very, very much indeed for such an interesting talk this evening. Before we thank Jan, I'd just like to make a couple of announcements about forthcoming events. Our next event will actually be in this room on Monday evening, so Monday 19th of January at 6 p.m, and we have a lecture by the Macedonian Deputy Prime Minister Fatmir Basimi on the subject of the Western Balkans and European Union mission to be completed. And then we will be followed 2 weeks today, again in this room, 6 p.m. usual time, for the next visiting speaker, and that's Florian Bieber from the University of Graz, who will be speaking on the crisis of democracy in the Balkans, the interrelationship between Europeanisation and the new authoritarian temptation. Jan, thank you again very much for coming along this evening. I think there was obviously a lot more questions and comments that people will have. I'm sure they can drop you a line if they want to follow up on things.
Good questions, actually.
And I certainly have a few questions, but I think that's one for a drink. Thank you very much indeed.